All right, any questions?
It is. It's just something that's very, it's stuck in this one.
Okay, lights? All right, we're talking about our ancestors, ancient astronomy, prehistoric astronomy, astronomy before people started writing things down. And the important thing to remember is that all of this stuff was based on observations. Probably some people managed to use very simple tools to help them look at and make measurements on the sky, and these simple tools became more elaborate as time went on. But simple tools, what would that be? It'd be a stick with two marks on it, or maybe one mark as a reference, and then you would slide your finger up and down if you wanted to measure the angular, or the, what looks like the linear distance on the sky, but we know it to be the angular distance. And you can do that. You can make very simple measurements with very simple tools. One of the interesting tools that the Arabs used, not as far back in time as the ancient times we're talking about, but essentially a piece of wood with a rope, little piece of string and a knot in it. And if you wanted to find where you were with reference to where you happened to live, and you use the North Star as a reference, you would hold this thing at a certain distance from your teeth like this, because that string would be a fixed distance, and you'd hold a piece of wood up and notice where the North Star was with relation to the horizon, and put a little mark. And then if you went north or south of that position, every time you did this, the North Star would be a little higher or a little lower. So you had a method of determining how far you moved north or south from a position. And many different cultures had similar things. So our ancestors were very clever on how to utilize things that were at hand to make some measurements. We're going to look today at other early discoveries that were made by our ancestors and the implication of those discoveries as they apply to astronomy. So we'll call these other early discoveries. And most of these tend to be definitional in nature. And the big one, of course, is this idea of a celestial sphere, that the entire sky is depicted, or actually shows itself to us, as if it were on a celestial sphere. And we normally would represent this as a hemisphere shape in a drawing, and we would put ourselves in the center of this thing, and the oval here, this would represent the base of that sphere, would represent your local horizon as you would look around. And then the celestial sphere would encompass that region around you as if there were an inverted bowl on which all the celestial objects would be visible to you, such as stars and planets and maybe a comet occasionally, or the meteors as they flash along the sky. So this idea was interesting because it seems to be what it looks like when you look out at the sky. Now, the idea is, why would you make it a spherical shape as opposed to just a flat thing? And again, if you probably had a world view that the world was flat, you would then think the sky would be maybe angular inside, maybe a box over you. But you didn't see any evidence of corners. And you would say, well, if you didn't see evidence of corners, then we don't have a box, so it's probably round. And of course, most people that live near the ocean, I would say all people near the ocean, did not consider that the Earth was flat. And if you think about this, if you've ever been by the ocean and watched a ship come from the distance, you notice that the ship isn't tiny when it's at the distance and then grows larger. You notice that you see a portion of the ship as it rounds the curvature of the Earth. You see more of it as it's getting larger. So people who live near the ocean probably never thought the Earth was flat. And just by their observations, if they weren't ships at all, and watching ships come in and coming and going, they would see this. So the idea of a celestial sphere is an important one. And then once you have this sphere, sort of like a screen, you can put things on it. One of the first things that our ancestors noticed would be what we call the celestial pole. And again, this is naive history, right? You want to go into great detail to determine all of these pieces of what I'm going to give you today. It didn't happen one day. Somebody sat down and said, I think I'll write all this stuff up, because they didn't have writing, so they couldn't write it all up. But these are the concepts that if you were a hunter-gatherer moving around, or if you stayed still at some point in time, our ancestors stood still and formed villages, and weren't hunter-gatherers. They grew their own food and took care of that need very precisely. These things would be self-evident to you because you were paying attention to the sky. And so one of the things would be the celestial pole. What this implied when you looked out at the sky is that there was motion going on. It looked like the entire sky was spinning around this point, which we would call the celestial pole. So our ancestors would notice this, and they would notice that the stars in the vicinity of the celestial pole would just go around and around all night, while some stars would actually rise and set. So if the sky is moving this way, if we define the cardinal points of the compass we're familiar with, so we have north, south, east in this direction, and west, then this is what we would see. Stars would be rising in the east and going overhead, and it would look like the sky is turning about the celestial pole. Now, of course, it's hard to understand if people way back when had the idea of a sphere as we think of sphericalness. If you're a little kid living today, probably no matter where you live on this planet, you probably have a ball or something like a ball, something round, because it's probably indigenous to your culture that you have some round things for whatever reason. And maybe part of this has to do with a tool that might be interested, you might be interested in using. Or this idea of an inverted bowl. If you were grinding corn, let's say, or some kind of grain, you would have one rock grinding against another and would ultimately make an indentation. So in normal everyday life, people would come up with models that they could then use for something else. So you would take the inverted bowl and put it like that, invert it, and you would have this idea of a sphere. But what about the rest of it? If you see the sky seem to moving around some point here, then you might think there's an opposite point that anchors the other end of it, so the whole thing can rotate like that. But not necessarily so, because you need that concept. It's difficult sometimes to try to think how our ancestors thought about things when we use a modern perspective, because they didn't have the exposure to the things that we're exposed to, and vice versa. And what happens many times is when people try to impart what it was like way back then, it's based on what it's like now, and that's not the correct framework. The only thing you could impart way back then is that people pretty much wanted to eat. And so their motivation was driven by that, as I was trying to explain with the calendrics, the calendar's start points. So, celestial pole. We are in the northern hemisphere, and I'm going to go back and forth from ancient to a more modern view. We are in the northern hemisphere, so we see what we'll call the north celestial pole. And for us, this happens to be marked by a star, more or less marked by a star called Polaris, the North Star. And as it turns out, it is not exactly at the center of this location. It's about 1 degree, 2 full moons away from it. So even Polaris makes a little circle around the pole. By the way, I will probably on Monday go through the stellarium activity, and we'll go through that and see how you all did. But you can use stellarium to see this. If you set it up for Tucson or any place, and you select the north sky and select Polaris, and then magnify a little bit, zoom in a little bit, and let the clock advance at a quick rate, you will notice that Polaris is making little circles. You might also increase the or add the grid system, so that you can see the celestial sphere with a grid, and that would be a reference. Because where the grid's lines intersect at the pole, you would think, there's Polaris, but you'll see it's offset, and you actually see it make a little circle. So the ancients, whether or not, it depends on how far back in time, they didn't have Polaris. Even going back 3,000-4,000 years, Polaris wasn't the North Star. There were a series of stars in the constellation Draco that took turns. Like, go back to around the time when we think the pyramids were built. The star then that was close to that point was a star called Thuban. So this also helps us determine when objects were built. If the idea was to build a pyramid so that you had a special shaft, for example, that looked at the north celestial pole at a particular star, and when you look at today and you don't see anything in it, then you could, because of our technology, we can advance the sky back in time with computers and see what star would have been in that hole, and that might indicate when the pyramid was built around that sight line. So this would be then in the realm of archaeoastronomy, I talked a little bit about. So today Polaris is more or less there. We now know that the entire sky is oscillating back and forth, and I'll give you a definition in a bit, but it's due to something called precession, and it causes our entire alignment of the sky to wobble. And it takes about 26,000 years to make one wobble. So if you run outside tonight and look at where Polaris is right at that moment, if you want to see it exactly at that moment, at that point on the sky, come back in 26,000 years and it'll be right there for you. Which means that in the interim, it's drifting away from that because of the wobble of the sky. But we'll deal with that more formally in a while. All right. Now, if you should make a line that connects your head, let's say, your point of view to the North Celestial Pole, and then 90 degrees away from that, you would have what we would call the celestial equator. Now, if you haven't figured it out, the North Celestial Pole is the North Pole of the Earth, just extended in space, and guess what the celestial equator would be? It's the Earth's equator extended into space. So this is a more modern idea. But the idea for the ancients is that they would see the sky rotate around their position, and some stars would be higher in the sky than others. And during different times of the year, the whole sky seems to behave differently. In terms of, let's say you wanted to follow the path of the sun, for example, and you use the horizon as a reference where the sun would rise, and then you were really clever and you not only used the horizon, but you built a wall of rocks, let's say, like the wall we have out there that I designed at the observatory, and you could sight in along the horizon, you could follow the movement of the sun, let's say, throughout the year. You'd also notice something else. Where it comes up on the horizon also depends on how high in the sky it would be. So this point would be a natural reference that you, if you were an ancient, you probably didn't pay too much attention to it, but you did pay attention to this other point on the sky, which would be this line that we're using to connect north and south. But that line goes through a special point which is right over your head, which is called the zenith. And I'll define these for you more formally in a minute. So the zenith would be the point that's right over your head. And if you connect a line from where north is to where south is, and that line passes right through the point over your head, that line has a special name. It's called the meridian. All right? So let me give you these things in more formal ways. So let's define the celestial pole. We'll define that as the point on the celestial sphere about which the sky or the celestial sphere, we'll just say the sky, that's interchangeable, celestial sphere, sky, about which the sky seems to rotate. Okay? Now, of course, the celestial pole also has another added advantage if you're navigating, moving away from your point of reference. You can measure how high it is above your horizon and ultimately measure your latitude, but we'll deal with that as well some other point. But for now, this is what our ancients were dealing with. The celestial equator we'll define as the, and of course these are imaginary lines now, imaginary from east to west, 90 degrees from the celestial pole, and there's one way of dividing the sky into sections, but the best way to divide the sky was using the meridian, but we'll define zenith. The zenith is defined as the point directly overhead for an observer. So this then implies that the zenith is a local point. It's where you're standing and it's right over your head. So if we all went outside as a group and we stayed pretty much as close as we are here, and I said, oh, look at your zenith because there's a really bright object up there, you'd all look up like this. And for being such a close group, we're in a little compact shape here, it's everybody's point of view. But if you saw this wonderful bright light and you called your friend in New York and said, hurry up, run outside, there's this bright object right over your head. Well, what you meant to say, it's right over my head, but right over your head in Tucson is not right over someone's head in New York. There's going to be approximately a shift of 45 degrees of the sky, because we're three time zones away. Right? We'll have to deal with that in a minute. So that person would run out, and if they looked right over their head, they wouldn't see the bright object, but they might see it on their horizon, or toward the horizon, about halfway toward the horizon. And they say, yeah, I see it, but I don't see right over my head. You would be looking toward the west, if you were in New York, seeing this thing about like that. When in Tucson, you'd be looking right over your head and seeing it. So zenith is a local thing. And that's fine, because it gives you a reference on the sky wherever you're standing, right overhead. The meridian also works this way, and it's also a local thing. The meridian is going to be defined as the imaginary line that runs from north to south, passing through your zenith. So that fixes it as a local line. The effect of this is to divide the sky in half. You now have two equal pieces of the sky, from the horizon to the meridian, from the meridian to the horizon. And then you also have something else. Yes?
If you were in New York and you were looking at the object that you can see in Tucson right overhead, what is it actually? southwest?
Yeah, more or less. More precisely southwest, but you wouldn't be looking east. Okay,
see? I'm making sure it's not.
No, you're right.
Part of the sky.
No. New York is up here, Tucson's down here, so you would be looking toward the west. That's all I meant. But yes, you're precisely southwest, of course. And that's good that you can visualize this. Now, this divides the sky in half. So now, if you're clever, you have a point on the celestial sphere which allows you, independently of rising or setting, of determining very precisely when something happens. So one of the things that's important to note, and probably our ancestors use this because it's convenient and easy to do, is to determine when half the day is gone. Right? Now, you would also pretty quickly learn that half the day, the amount of time for half the day changes throughout the year. So when half the day went, in modern terminology, when the sun was at that point on your meridian, then we call it noon. And if you wanted to find when that happened, or let's say you wanted to go the opposite way, you wanted to find where north and south was located, very simple to do. All you need is a stick. You poke a stick in the ground so it's perpendicular to the ground where you poke the stick. And you do this and wait for the sun to rise. And as soon as the sun starts rising, you watch the shadow that's being made. And you put a pebble at the end of the shadow from the stick and do that throughout the day. And what you will notice eventually is that there's one point where the shadow is going to be as large as it's going to be throughout the day. And once you have that, if you imagine the shadows moving in this direction, you just extend the line to the horizons and you have north and south. And you also have when the sun was on the meridian, when the shadow is at its longest or shortest. If you actually do it, you might be surprised on what you would expect to find with a perpendicular stick. So if you like to do things, maybe over the weekend, stick in the ground perpendicular and start off about 10 o'clock in the morning and see where the shadow is and pull a rock there and do it at 10:30, 11:30, 11 o'clock, 11:30, every half hour until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then make a discovery of where north and south is and when the sun was on the meridian. You can't use your clock for this because this is artificial. All right. If you want solar time, you got to use the sun. Now, more modern times, we divide the sky the same way, and we use two terms, AM and PM. Guess what the M is?
Meridian.
A, ante, means before the meridian. P, post, after the meridian. So we even divide the sky this way, and we call morning anything between when the sun is rising to get to the meridian. Then it's noon, special time. It's on the meridian, it's crossing it. And then as it continues west, we call post-meridian or PM. See? So now you know where AM and PM come from. So this is not our ancestors' definitions, this is ours. But the concept was there. They knew, one half of the day was this and the other half of the day was that, and they probably had equivalent words in their languages. So, anti-meridian and post-meridian. Okay. So now we have a division of the sky and a way of determining time, which was independent of rising or setting. We actually now can measure the time. So if you wanted to, you could build an artificial mechanism to keep track of some arbitrary units of passage, and then you could divide the sky into these arbitrary units. But what you would discover very quickly is that at different times of the year, the day was shorter at some point and longer at other points. And then sometimes it was equal. The day and the night were equal. So then you were clever and you discovered that, hey, this is connected to what we now call seasons and to agricultural necessities of planting or harvesting crops. So our ancestors had these concepts. Whether they used these identical words, that's another story, but they had the concept, and this was one of the important concepts. Now, of course, in modern times, when we deal with this idea of the meridian, since it's a local concept, and it's a local definition of passing through your zenith, everyone's meridian is different, which means everyone's noon passage is different, depending upon where you are. So if you're east or west of some point, then if you happen to be west of a point, the person who's east of you, the sun has passed their meridian before your meridian. So, for example, when it's 9 o'clock in the morning in New York, what is it here? With 6 o'clock, all right? But when you go back, when everybody else goes back to standard time, then it's only 7, you see? So, what's that all about? Well, in this country anyway, there was a need to standardize time zones. And you say, why? Well, we had a railroad. And now you can get people from place to place faster than they could normally get from place to place. And so the idea of trying to standardize time became very important. For example, if you had to catch the train, you wanted to know what time you caught the train. And if you were using solar time, using a sundial, and the train came at 1 p.m. in the afternoon, whose 1 p.m. was it? You know, from where the train left, or where the train's going to be halfway through, or where the train is when it gets to you. So what time do you stand out there waiting for the train? Yeah, it's a naive example, but you get the point. So standardization of time zones became important. And unfortunately, as most things happen, they become political too. So when you look at the way time zones are built in this country, you sort of scratch your head and say, why do they make it go way out there and around and then back? Well, Eastern time zone is very interesting to watch when you look at the limits, because some people wanted to be on Eastern time. I guess if you're on the East Coast, you know, that's very important. So politically, you want to be on Eastern time. So you just arbitrarily made the line go around, you know, these things. Instead of following maybe some natural boundary, you created it. And then it becomes a political entity. But it doesn't help you any other way other than you assign a standardization of time. In general, the Earth is divided into 15-degree chunks. Now you'd say, where'd that number come from? Divide 24 into 360. What do you get? Do it. Somebody have a calculator handy? Divide 24 into 360. What do you got? 15. Oh my goodness. 360 is 360 degrees. Circle. 24 hours in a day. So, approximately. So the idea was, let's divide the Earth into 24 equal intervals of time. So each one would be 15 degrees. So this became important when people started sailing around the world. They wanted to know where they were with reference to where they left. Something called longitude. So the lines of longitude are based on this. And our time zones are based this way. And, of course, you need a start and an end point. Right? The start and the end point is Greenwich, England. There's a, you can go there, the Greenwich Observatory. You can see this, I mean, there's like an embedded line in the sidewalk and stuff. And you can see when you're on, you know, where Greenwich Mean Time starts and so on. But then you needed to also account for something where you have a day change. And so you had, we invented the International Date Line. When I was in the ninth grade, I guess I was in ninth grade, I was thinking, whoa, I could build a time machine. All you had to do was run around at the pole, you know, and you go different days, except that would be fine, but it's not a natural occurrence. It's totally artificial. So then I can totally artificially say, I just went forward in time. And everybody would laugh at me and say, no, you didn't, it's still today. You know, so you get these little problems, right, with these artificial descriptions of time. But the idea is that they can be helpful, and they are helpful because we can standardize time. So anything within a 15-degree swath on the Earth, by convention, is defined as the same time, a standard time zone. You see? So this came out of this old observation of our ancestors. And in the modern world, you needed to build something to tell you what time it was, independent of the sun. So you built clocks. And clocks were a big deal. In the 1700s, a lot of good work on clocks were made. And then you went off solar time and you went to clock time, standard time. Now think about this. Our ancestors, when the sun went down and you didn't have artificial lighting, you either made more ancestors or you went to sleep. Right? And you were afraid. And you look at all the stories from different cultures, and it was scary at night, right? And of course, if you lived right in the middle of a real wild environment where there were animals who wake up at night looking for you if you weren't hiding someplace, then you became their supper. So it was scary, and then we went off that cycle. So it was interesting. Can you imagine a time when people would wake up with the sun and then go to sleep when the sun set? Which means during the course of a year, your length of night varied. So you didn't sleep the same amount all the time. And you didn't even notice it. Because if someone said, what time is it? Oh, sun just came up. That's all you knew. You didn't look at your watch and say, oh, you know, like now you look at your watch in the morning and, it's not as light as it was, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And but you still have to get up at the same time, right? Because you have things to do. So it's sort of an artificial way. So interesting, when you tie the biological to the definitional in terms of, celestial activity, our ancestors were onto something that, you know, you didn't notice any other way. Some scientists have done experiments with these rhythms, the so-called rhythms that our bodies are attuned to, and one of them deals with this waking and sleeping cycle. And one of the experiments that was performed was, do we really have this like 8 hours worth of sleep that you hear people talk about? And if you were left without any connection to the sky, in other words, you're in a cave, all right, and you just had artificial light, you could stay up 24 hours and not know it, and then sleep for a time, and you would not have this normal day-night cycle that you think is the important one. And this was a surprise, because if your body is left up to its own devices, it'll do whatever it needs to do happily. But if you have artificial clues outside of it, then your body reacts to it. So very interesting, some of these studies. And if you're interested in such stuff, you should look into that, this physiology of sleep or sleep deprivation, and see what that implies. Okay. Another definition, and I told you I'd give you this, is heliacal, or helical, however you wish to say it, rising. Now this became important because, as we'll see with the definition, the heliacal rising implies a very precise measurement of time as to some celestial event. So what we could say when we talk about heliacal rising is, first of all, guess which direction on the horizon we're going to be looking. North, south, east, or west? East, rising. Okay. So heliacal rising then is going to be defined as the following. This is what occurs on the first day each year when, and typically a star, but it can be any celestial object on the celestial sphere, but that's fixed as a star would be. So each year when a star, and it'll be a particular one for that particular day, can be seen just before dawn. Now, what does this mean? This means that as you're looking at this object, the star glimmers near the horizon, not on the horizon, but somewhere in the vicinity of the horizon, near the horizon, a minute or two before the rising sun, the rising sun's light brightens the sky. So in other words, the day before this event, you can't see the star. The day of this event, it's just visible. And the day after, it's above the brightness of the sky because it's rising before the sun does. So this is a very, very important observation to make, because it's that fine an observation that you can actually observe the day when you can start your calendar. Now, since it's near the horizon, there are other things that are going to affect the visibility of this event. If there's a huge amount of water vapor in the horizon, that's going to affect what this object will look like, if it's nice and sharp or if it's undulating, right? If there's a lot of dust in the atmosphere, you may not see it because the dust will be bright and you might miss that. As we have heliacal rising, we also have heliacal setting, which would be in the west watching the setting object. And why our ancestors would have picked both of these, if you needed to start your calendar on a particular day and miss that day because it was cloudy in the morning, you still had an option at night. So you had at least two objects per observation. Now, as I told you last time, the in Peru, the important object was the Pleiades rising heliacally. So now instead of one star, you've got a group of them. And that would then begin their celestial calendar, which was attached to their agricultural calendar. Tohono O'odham used the Pleiades as well to determine when the monsoon would begin. What they would do is watch this group of stars rise, and if the group of stars, when you looked at the Pleiades, they were very like points of light, unwavering, then the monsoon would not be starting soon. If they were sort of undulating, then the monsoon would be starting within a week of that observation. And you would say, wow, what are they, mystical? No. They were observing a phenomena that we can understand to make sense. If the atmosphere is devoid of water vapor, the star's image is going to be very sharp and bright because we live in a very dry environment. If there's water vapor, you're going to see a lot of undulation and sort of a bloating of the images. And that tells you there's water vapor. So by making many observations over many years, that people saw this connection. And the Egyptians used the same thing with the star Sirius, which would then indicate to them the flooding of the Nile would occur. This was independent of what it looked like, but it was dependent upon the actual time when this happened, so they could start their ceremonial calendars and agricultural calendars.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about heliacal setting. I take it it's at the west, but it's on the last day of each year.
Then you can just see it.
Dusk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the next day you won't see it. Yeah.
Are these commonly called morning stars and evening stars?
The morning star, evening star is usually applied to Venus as a planet, and sometimes Mercury. But these would be, they could be stars, and they don't have to be Sirius or the Pleiades. It could be whatever is important to that culture. And maybe you have a special holiday that's associated with another star, so you know when that holiday is going to occur. So you had the sky watches. Now, in a dry climate, such as we live, in a desert environment, a lot of this stuff was done. These observations were made, very important. But also consider the fact that a group of people would be assigned to make these observations. They were the sky watchers, and they would have special places they would stand. They were sacred sites. And you look around the Southwest, there are a lot of these sacred sites, and some of the tribes, they don't even talk about them to anybody because they're sacred to them, so they're not going to talk about it. But they won't tell you where they are, they'll tell you that they exist. And occasionally you could find a place maybe where somebody would stand and wait for 2 weeks. You wouldn't just do it on the day you thought it would happen because you might miss it. So you wait for 2 weeks and you bracket it. You make observations that are called brackets before and after the event, and then you can nail it down. So even if you missed it, you had a pretty good idea when it happened. And if you were the sky watcher, that was your job. You needed to tell when the calendar would start. So interesting story, Tumamak Hill, out that way somewhere, right? The... A lot of there were petroglyphs up on Tumamak Hill, and so people actually use that as a site for something. Probably since it was a high point in the valley, if you wanted to watch who was doing what, that's a good place to stand. And up there, there are places where it looks like there are these shallow indents, and if you fit, it's like a mortar and pestle, with people would grind corn, and there are some smaller holes. And so I remember years ago someone called me and said, oh, is there a place, an alignment up there? I've been up to Tumamak Hill and I found that if you put your shoulder against this rock this way and sort of twisted like that and then looked over this rock toward the Catalinas, that must mean something. And I said, maybe. What else was there? Oh, there's an indented area with small holes. They must have had some sticks there. And then one explanation might be that, or it might be, well, maybe this is where a mother would be grinding corn with the kid, and the kid's playing in the rocks too, and making their own little holes and playing some game too. So you can get carried away with this archaeoastronomy stuff and significance if you don't look at it within the cultural context of who's doing the work, right? So it's interesting, but you have to be careful. The other thing is... if you're making an observation, say a horizontal observation to the horizon, and a level, then maybe you had to have a certain height, because maybe your sight was based on the height of that person making the observation. And if you were too tall, maybe you might find evidence of a hole. Or if you were too short, you might find evidence of a mound. Or maybe they only picked people who, when they stood the way it existed, their eye was that tall. So we don't know. Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, it was called the Sun Dagger. And on the first day of summer, it would be in shadow. There'd be a petroglyph that was a spiral shape. And then as the sun would rise and move toward the zenith, a dagger of light looked like it would go, move through and penetrate the center of that circle. And the question is, did somebody actually align these rocks, or were the rocks already that way and they carved the petroglyph behind that light? And we don't have the answer to that, because as it turns out, the rock slipped because of erosion, so it doesn't do that anymore. And or somebody did it, because you could go up there and actually see it, but now it's they won't let you go up on top of that rock to see it. So very interesting things that are attached to these concepts that our ancestors were well aware of. Constellations. I would say most cultures had some type of constellations. They would group stars that they would see in meaningful ways for them. Having said that, then, constellations are not universal. The actual patterns. And in stellarium, when you use that, you can choose which culture. You might be interested to see what they thought the sky looked like. And you might be surprised to see that not everybody sees the Big Dipper the way we see the Big Dipper. So it's a fun little exercise to go in there and actually see how other cultures saw these things. But the question you might ask is, why do people even bother dealing with these groups of stars in some meaningful way for them? And probably the biggest thing is that people were using constellations as memory aids. And these memory aids would be maybe to do with some historical series of events, or maybe some religious stuff. But by and large, probably one of the most important things would have been in navigation. If you were a seafaring culture and you move away from shore, out of sight of shore, you need to get back or go wherever you're going. And constellations might be important for you. So these memory aids then, as we would say, would be constellations. These would be groups of stars connected in such a way as to tell or show, because they're not talking to you, or show some significant event or story. And then also they could be used for navigation. You could remember certain aspects of what was important on the sky for your trip, let's say. The Polynesians really were into this. The Greeks, not so much. They had constellations. We got the names from the constellations we're familiar with. Apparently came from the Greeks. But the interesting thing is within the constellations, there are individual stars that have names that are Arabic. So we could see the cultural exchange that occurred over historical time. The Greeks tended to sail within sight of land. They weren't like seafarers. And if you, I was in Greece this summer, and for one reason I wanted to see what this looked like, and went to the various islands, and it's amazing because you're never out of sight of the islands. Now if a storm comes up, then you could have a problem, and it gets really windy in the Aegean Sea. And you could see how these ancient ships could have been sunk or blown off course. And then you look at some of these stories, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the stuff that Homer wrote. And they're lost for 20 years, you know, and they got these epic things. And how do you can't get lost for 20 years in the Aegean. I mean, if you did nothing, you're going to bang into something eventually. But they were telling other stories with this. All right, so very interesting. So they typically didn't go, you know, like, oh, let's go across the Atlantic. It probably, who would want to? It's so beautiful there. Why would you want to go anyplace else? But very interesting environment, as opposed to the Polynesians, who lived in the ocean. And one of the interesting things I found about found out about the Polynesians, the Hawaiians, the Tahitians, is that their entire navigational system was based on the sky. And one way that they would pass this knowledge throughout their culture is a father would pass the knowledge to his son. When the kid became a certain age, the father would show them all the secrets. They have their star charts. They would have charts on skins or whatever they used as a medium to draw stuff on. And the dad would take the kid out into the ocean with the charts and show the kid how to use them, how to interpret them. And for the final exam, the dad would get off the boat literally and say, okay, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. And if the kid came back, he was successful, he passed. If it didn't, that was the end of that. And so you didn't have to worry about getting the wrong information passed along. And it sounds sort of cruel and how terrible, but that's how it worked. You know, I was in Peru at Machu Picchu, and there's the Inca Trail. See that? That's about how wide it was in some spots. And 2,000 foot drop, okay? And that's people go. That's how they got around. They just walked. So I guess when you reach a certain point in your life, if you couldn't stay on the trail, you didn't have to worry about Medicare, because that was it. So that's the reality. I mean, that's where we came from. And now, you didn't want this to happen, but that was it. And the ones who did, they were successful, and that's where we came from. We came from the ones who came back when they learned how to sail, and who could walk without falling off the edge. And so now, what are you doing about it? You see? Right? So maybe humanity is heading downhill now. I don't know. But these things are all connected, and in a way that helped determine survival. And again, we came from ancestors who were survivors. They knew how to deal with this stuff, as harsh as it was. You know, today a lot of people think food is made in a supermarket. You know, I have no idea that, no, there's a place someplace that had to kill the cow and then package it up so you could buy hot dogs. But yeah, I know, there is. We're so disconnected from the reality of existing that it's, you know, you think about how precarious it is. You just go to the supermarket and buy what you want, right? Suppose the delivery trucks didn't show up for a week. And not even a week, a day.
Right.
You know, think about it. There are a lot of people that are going to starve to death. They won't want to, so then they're going to react accordingly, and then you end up with the problems that you had throughout history. So we live well. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. It's a good life right now. Even in some of the poorest places in this country, you really don't have to worry too much about eating. There are places on this planet you have to worry about it. I mean, go to some of the African nations, and it doesn't rain for a few months, and then, oh, gee, corn didn't grow. What's that mean? You don't eat. That's it. I mean, you can't even conceive of that. You know, oh, we're in a drought now. Does any one of us feel the drought? No, you still go to the store and buy stuff. Right? So it's sort of artificial how we live today, but it's good because we're able to deal with it. Our ancestors were able to deal with it. I don't know how they dealt with it. See this? This is from biological necessity. Except we reach a certain age, if you don't move around as much as you should, or you eat more than you should, this is what happens. This is survival thing. That's what fat is. It's survival. And this is helpful, so I can go a few weeks without food, so I'm not worried. But if you're like a rail, good luck. So anyway, constellations, memory aids, navigation. If we look at our own culture, and we try to understand where the constellation names came from, one quick way to do this is look at the celestial sphere, for example, where the Greeks live. And since a lot of the constellation names are Greek, let's see what it was like when we think they were named. And the book we have, where a lot of these constellations are in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. And you could see that he has the definition. And the Theogony is where all this is written down. The Theogony gave the explanation for the Greek gods and all the constellation names. But the question is, where did that information come from? So if we start and look at this, one guy named Overton, Professor Overton, came up with an interesting idea, and people don't like his idea anymore today. But he said, let's process the sky back in time to around when we think these names were given. And he used the island of Crete, the Cretan civilization. And we know its longitude and latitude on Earth. We know what the celestial sphere would look like, say, 2,000 years ago from that location. Which stars were visible in the sky that we know have names? And so this is what he did, and he said, yeah, this is makes sense. They could see these stars. The names of the constellations have to do with the neat stories about some of the Homeric hymns that they talk about, the heroes and the Greek gods, the theology of the Greek gods at the time. And it all fit, except a guy named Alex Gerstein, a professor from Russia, he looked at the constellations and he said, that doesn't make sense because some of the constellations don't seem to belong in the sky as they are now. And he used examples of like constellation Aquarius, okay, the water bearer. And then you also would have Leo the lion, all right, and then you would have Libra. The scales, And these are inconsistent. You know, you've got a water sign, you've got an earth sign, you've got something that has nothing to do with anything, but it talks about equal. What's this about? So he did a mathematician, and he did an extensive series of calculations and discovered that the constellations as they're named today are much older than 2,000 years, 3,000 years. They go back 20, possibly 30,000 years, and they probably originate from the Greeks. And what he was using as a common thread to help explain his theory is that the constellations had to be useful. Well, how would they be useful? Again, it would be agriculture. You would have a constellation scheme that would help you determine such things as springtime, when you could expect moisture. And so the names of the constellations are related to these ideas of earth, wind, fire, and water. And he said that the way they're arranged on the sky now is not the way they originally started out, and he came up with his own scheme. So you had two ideas from two different people, Overton and Gerstein. You can look up these names and see, as they relate to constellations, what their works were. Nobody likes either one of them, apparently. I met Gerstein. I had a nice chat with him for a couple hours years ago in Washington at an American Astronomical Society meeting. And I was the only one who listened to him. Everyone else sort of politely left. But he was a very interesting character, very intelligent. He left Russia. He was like the top mathematician in the Academy of Mathematics in Russia. And just before Russia went belly up, he wanted out because he said, I want my kids to be raised in a nice place. And so he left. And he was a top dog there. When he came here, he teaches at a community college in Colorado. But he's happy. His kids are happy. They're all Americanized now. And but he has a very interesting theory and worked on it for a number of years. And it makes sense. But people don't like it because it doesn't fit the normal archaeological aspects of things, like human civilization is 6,000 years old. Well, this would imply that human civilization goes back thousands of years, and of course that gives some people a hot burn. So it's good to look at alternative views, especially when you deal with stuff that's ancient, because the bottom line is we don't know. A couple of years ago, what would they call this guy? They found this dead guy in the Alps, and apparently the snow had receded and his frozen body was seen. And they analyzed this this guy's body. It was almost perfectly preserved. And it sort of turned archaeology on its head, because people weren't supposed to go over the Alps.
He had metal.
He had metal. His shoes.
Something that wasn't.
Right. He had types of tattoos. He had his shoes were, and the way his clothes were made, the stitching was supposed to have come later, and apparently it was earlier. And the food content in his stomach was indicative of the fact that this guy actually was on the other side of the Alps and was coming over. Maybe was murdered or was ambushed or something, or fell. They weren't able to tell. But the thing is, he was in time where he shouldn't have been in time. He should have been 2,000 years, say, ahead of that time, and it was actually 2,000 years behind when they did the dating. So archaeological things, at best, could be a problem. When you marry archaeology with astronomy, you start getting something that's very interesting. When I was in Peru, one of my visits there, I took one of my colleagues from Pima, who was on the West Campus in the archaeology department, and she was an expert in Native American stuff, archaeology and such things, but she'd never been to South America to see some of the things there. So, yeah, she was all excited to go. And before we went, because I had some work to do, we had to test out some equipment. And what I noticed was very interesting. We watched an archaeologist in the field. Archaeologists in the field always look down. And they're good at what they see. They could say, yep, the ground was disturbed right there, I can tell, because it's a different shade of brown. And you say, oh man, how do you see that? And you go over and you see, sure enough, there were like rats, you know, a little rat pack was there. And you just move the stuff around and you could see it was different. And of course, astronomers always look up like that, right? And when you get up and down at the same time at a site, you can start making some interesting discoveries. And that started to happen. And archaeologists became more in tune to using some high-tech equipment, which they all use now. They use ground-penetrating radar. They use total stations. They're called surveying instruments. And they pay attention to where things line up and how they line up. So it's changing. They're into using high-tech dating methods to determine how old stuff is. And when you start putting this together, things change. And the timeline starts to expand further back than we thought. But it's still uncomfortable because you still have lots of pressures in the academic community to say, you can't think that far back. We don't have any evidence. Well, yeah, we do. Here it is, right here. So it's very interesting to see how different aspects of different sciences function. But I can tell you from my naive point of view, when we deal with astronomy, there are certain things that are just the way they are. You know, the sky is what it is. And over time, it changes in a very predictable way. So you don't have to worry about someone's opinion. Oh, that constellation didn't look like that then. Everything's changing. The fact is, it's not changing as fast as you think. I've always been involved with astronomy since I was a little kid. And I learned the constellations when I was 10 years old. In the winter, I would be outside in the field in a big snowsuit, laying down, looking up with my star chart. It took me like a year to figure out how the star chart works because the scale's different, right? You're looking for the Big Dipper, and the stars on the star chart are only this far apart. And you look in the sky, and they're that far apart. So you've got to figure that all out. But the thing is, I learned the constellations. And guess what? They're the same now. You know, I can still go out 50 years later and I can still see the same constellations. They're my friends. So they've changed, but not by much. Now, in 10,000 years, if I could go out and look, I would notice a difference. Some of the constellations are going to look a little different. Stars move slightly. In 100,000 years, I wouldn't even recognize the sky because of everything moving. But over periods of time, it's predictable, and I can predict how it will look. So it's a very important aspect of trying to get a handle on our history. Okay, any questions? Yes?
Can you define precession?
Oh, yeah. I was going to do that next time, but I'll define it next time. But that's essentially the wobble of the Earth, all right? I'll give you a couple more definitions. Any other questions? Yeah.
I'm just confused. In measuring along the horizon, how do you make those measurements? I can see the 90 degrees, but is that what the...
I don't understand your question. How do you measure along? You just look.
On the assignment that we did, it shows it in a circle.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you use your protractor to do that, or how do you...
Okay. You could use a protractor, but you could guess probably better.
Okay.
Just sort of look at it, and by inspection, you know, say, okay, this is supposed to look like this is 0, 90, 180, 270, and then guesstimate. Yeah. Any other questions? All right, lights, please. See you next time. Anyone have to go to the observatory? Okay. No.
Hey, sir, I got a question, actually. It's about next week. I have a
Wait a minute. Let me just turn this off.